Fire engineering podcasts are sponsored by MSA. Firefighters want to be connected to each other, to dispatch, and to their commanders. MSA has created Lunar, a wireless, handheld device that includes thermal imaging, firefighter ranging, motion alarm, and cloud technology with GPS. It's part of the new connected firefighter platform from MSA. Learn more at msafire.com.
Taking It to the Streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to both the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. The focus at Taking It to the Street continues to be straightforward street-level talk with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussion with interactive dialogue and, most importantly, listener participation. Just like around the kitchen table or in the day room over a cup of coffee at 02:30 after a good run. And now, the latest edition of Taking It to the Streets with your host, Christopher Nall.
Welcome to this edition of Taking It to the Streets. I'm your host, Christopher Naum. This evening, we're sharing with you an encore presentation of a historical event that occurred in 1966 that we recorded in 2018. The tragic events of October 17, 1966 in Manhattan's Flatiron District began with resident Herbert Brown. At approximately 9:30 p.m., on the same evening, he had just finished reading a magazine article about the deadly Chicago fire and how Mrs. O'Leary's cow infamously had kicked over a lamp that would set the Windy City on fire in 1871. He smelled smoke inside his own fourth-floor apartment in a four-story brownstone on 7 East 22nd Street. Concerned, Mr. Brown would check throughout his apartment for a source. Failing to discover anything wrong in his apartment, he went down to the third floor, which was occupied by the Daniels Lamp Company, to locate the source of the burning odor. Again, he found no sign of smoke, heat, or fire. Mr. Brown then went to the roof of an extension and at the third floor level of the rear of the building. There he saw smoke coming out from around the roof and skylight of the two-story extension that connected his building with a five-story structure at 6 East 23rd Street. His fear of a fire was confirmed. Mr. Brown quickly returned to his apartment, and his wife immediately called the fire department. Mr. and Mrs. Brown decided to wake up their four children, dress them, and take them to the street as a precautionary measure, even though there was no smoke present in their apartment yet. As they began to awaken the children, the apartment filled with smoke, and the lights went out. The Manhattan dispatcher received the call from Mrs. Brown at approximately 9:36 p.m., and transmitted box 598, Broadway and 21st Street. The bell sounded, and engines 14, 3, and 16, ladders 3 and 12, and Battalion Chief Frederick White of the 6th Battalion and Deputy Chief Thomas Riley of Division 3 responded. As Mr. and Mrs. Smith and their children reached the sidewalk safely, first two companies were rolling to a stop in front of the 20 by 100-foot building at 7 East 22nd Street. Engine 14, first to arrive in front of the building, saw nothing from the street. Checking with a calling party, companies found a cellar fire beneath 7 East 22nd Street. A heavy volume of smoke and heat was pushing from the cellar and first floor of the building. The cellar was occupied by an art dealer, and the lower floors of the building were occupied by lamp and shade manufacturers. The origin of the fire was evident to the first two units. At 9:46 p.m., the Holmes Protective Company received an indication of a break in their circuit at number 6th East 23rd Street. Two Holmes employees arrived and opened the Wonder Drugstore and found a light smoke condition there. Again, the origin of the fire was not clear. Meanwhile, ladder 3, forced entry to the first floor art store at 7 East 22nd Street, while Ladder 12 raised the ladder to the roof, vented at the location, and searched the upper floors. While Ladder 3 searched the first floor, Engine 14 advanced a hose line through the store to the interior stairs on the east side of the store. They encountered a heavy, intense heavy heat, and they descended into the stairs of the cellar. Engine 3 stretched a line to the second floor via the stairs and operated the line after being confronted with a tremendous heat condition. Unable to locate the origins of the fire, and as heat conditions intensified in the cellar at number 7 East 22nd Street, Chief White determined that immediate extinguishment of the cellar fire was not possible. He withdrew the units from the area and concentrated efforts on controlling the first and higher floors. At 9:59, Chief Riley transmitted an all-hands which brought Rescue 1, Battalion 7, and field communication units to the scene. Rescue 1 is directed to the 7 East 22nd Street, where members stretched a line with Engine 14. At approximately the same time, while summoning duty, firefighter Carl Lee stopped by Ladder 7 quarters and found that the members listening to the fire department. He voluntarily signed himself into the company journal and made himself eligible to respond to the fire. Back at 7 East 22nd Street, Chief Riley requested an additional truck company at 10:03 p.m. Ladder 7 turned out under the command of Lieutenant Jack Finley, a 29-year veteran of the fire department. Ladder 7 initially operated in heavy smoke and smoke on the second floor of East 22nd Street. And after a short while, they were ordered by Chief Riley to see what was showing around the corner on the 23rd Street. They were joined by Battalion Chief Walter Higgins of Battalion 7, who operated with Ladder 3. At 10:06 hours, the Mask Service Unit number 41 was special called. Chief Riley ordered a second alarm at 10:08. Deputy Chief Alan Hay of Division 1 arrived at 10:09. Engines 1, 5, 18, and 33, along with Searchlight 21 and the Super Pumper System, Safety Unit Car 500, and the Phono Unit Car 33 arrived. Deputy Chief Harold Goble arrived and assumed command. By the time the second alarm was transmitted, fire had extended to an L-shaped, three-story brick commercial structure located at 940 Broadway on the northeast corner of Broadway and East 22nd Street. Fire had also spread to 6 East 23rd Street, a five-story brick commercial loft building with three stores on the first floor, the Wonder Drugs, Fans, a woman's dress shop, and Barton's Candy Store. Chief Riley was sent to take charge of the 23rd Street operations. Located at 7 East 22nd Street, this was a four-story brick and joist brownstone-like structure. The building measured 20 by 100 feet. This was a two-story extension in the rear to allow the building to connect to the rear of the building at number 6 East 23rd Street. The cellar and first floors were used for art framing and preservation. Artists sent their canvases to this location, where they would tack them to rough frames and spray them with lacquer. They were then mounted on decorative frames and sold or shipped. This business operation was extended into the cellar of number 6 East 23rd Street by 35 feet. The new rear wall, a cinder block partition of the cellar, was constructed to separate the cellar from the cellar of 6 East 23rd Street. This occupancy was contrary to the certificate of occupancy. 10 people were employed by this company. Inside the cellar, as part of the process of the business, there were significant drums of lacquer. The fourth floor was used as a residence by the Brown family. The residence was also contrary to the certificate of occupancy. At the time of the fire, the buildings department considered number 7 East 22nd Street and number 6 East 23rd Streets to be one building due to the interconnections. Located at 6 East 23rd Street, this building was a five-story brick and joist building. It was measured 50 by 100 feet. The first floor was divided into three occupancies: the Wonder Drug Store, the Fans Lingerie Store, and Barton's Candy Store. The Wonder Drug Store was L-shaped. There were two cinder block partitions erected in the cellar under the Wonder Drug Store. The only occupancy on the first floor to have access to the cellar was the Wonder Drug Store. One partition had arched openings leading to the other cinder block partition. It was only about 65 feet from the front of the building. It was deceiving. It appeared to be as if the cinder block walls in the end of the buildings were present. The cinder block partition went from the concrete floor to the underside of the floor. The other side of the cinder block wall connected to E7 East 22nd Street. The Department of Buildings had no record of approving these cinder block partitions. On the first floor, there was a terrazzo floor installed on top of the wood floor joists. These floor joists were 3x14 and covered with 3/4-inch planking. These floor joists were attached to the brick bearing walls in joist pockets. This addition was not approved by the Buildings Department. The terrazzo floor consisted of 5 inches of concrete poured on top of the wood joist. Due to the interconnections, the Department of Buildings considered 7 East 22nd Street and 6 East 23rd Street to be one building. This program is dedicated to the memory of the 12 brave FDNY members who made the supreme sacrifice on October 17, 1966, at what is known as the 23rd Street Fire. Deputy Chief Thomas A. Riley of Division 3, Battalion Chief Walter J. Higgins of Battalion 7, Lieutenant John J. Finley of Ladder 7, Lieutenant Joseph Priori, Engine Company 18, Firefighter John G. Berry, Ladder 7, Firefighter James V. Glagnlaw of Engine 18, Firefighter Rudolph Kaminsky of Ladder 7, Firefighter Joseph Kelly of Engine 18, Firefighter Carl Lee of Ladder 7, Firefighter William McCarran of Division 3, Firefighter Daniel L. Rye of Engine 18, and Firefighter Bernard A. Tepper of Engine Company 18. Join us for this encore presentation of the 2018 episode of Taking It to the Streets, the 23rd Street Fire, Box 55-598, with our special guest, Deputy Chief Vinnie Dunn, retired FDNY.
Is as follows: daycare center, 2-story, 120x120, class 1. Approximately 5 old children after school hours, senior citizens on the second floor.
South Engine 11.
Engine 11.
We're still out here, a full steel. We just had an explosion. We had an apartment that exploded. Terrific to channel 2. That 1030, advise. 1030, direct. Give me a location, Southend.
And Lilac.
Southend, we have a working fire out here.
Big Piper and Lilac for engine 7, engine 4, engine 2, engine 1, 27, sprint 1, rescue 1, fire 1.
Yeah, Battalion 1 to Main Emergency, give me a box. I'm going to set the stationary at Chicago Lake Shore Drive. I'll give you the stairwells in a minute, office. We have a fire up there.
Main to 271, 271.
271.
We have report of 3 people on the roof in need of rescue. 3 people on the roof in need of rescue.
3 people on the roof in need of rescue. Message received.
your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Taking It to the Streets is all about fireground leadership and advancing operational excellence on today's demanding fireground. With straightforward street-level talk, with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussions, and interactive dialogue with leading national and international fire service leaders and guests on important issues affecting the American fire service with applications internationally within the tradition and brotherhood of the fire service. So, grab a cup of coffee and sit down for this edition of Buildings on Fires, Taking It to the Streets. And now here's your host, Christopher Naum.
Welcome to this edition of Taking It to the Streets. I'm your host, Christopher Naum. On your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world, Taking It to the Streets is a monthly radio talk show program hosted by FireEngineering.com on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And again, this evening, we are talking about a lessons learned in history event on the FDNY 23rd Street Fire, of which the anniversary is October 17th. This event occurred in 1966. And again, our discussion tonight, joining us is Deputy Chief Vinnie Dunn, FDNY retired again, and my good close colleague, Joseph Prenesti from Elyria, Ohio. So welcome, gentlemen, and thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Taking It to the Streets.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And Chief
good to
Dunn,
be here.
Yeah, thanks for Chief Dunn taking time out of his schedule to, again, provide some insights. Now, for our listeners who aren't familiar with this program or those that have some insights, the 23rd Street Fire, as it's referred to, occurred on October 17th, 1966, in Manhattan's Flatiron District. And, again, it was an evening fire, occurred in the early evening hours, and led to a significant challenging operation, multiple alarm fire, that ultimately took the lives of 12 firefighters in FDNY. And prior to 9/11, it was the largest loss fire in the history of the fire department. Chief Dunn, again, had the was called in. So Chief Dunn was obviously working on that in that particular evening. And just to give a little intro as we get into this, Chief Dunn was a lieutenant at the time on 33 engine and, again, came in on the second alarm. So our focus tonight is just talking a little bit about the events, the building, the challenging operations firsthand from Chief Dunn's perspective and some of the learnings that came out of it. So, Chief, if you can provide a little bit of background or insights, we'll turn it over to you.
Okay, Chris, thank you. Well, it was a typical evening in the firehouse. 33 engine responded to box 598, a second alarm. We arrived at a fire in front of 7 East 22nd Street with a brownstone. Heavy fire and smoke was coming out of the basement underneath the stoop. There was a stoop to the second floor, and the fire, as you could see, was very severe coming out of the basement. Rescue 1 was trying to take a hose line down there, and they were not successful. I reported to the command post in front of the building, Chief Harry Goebbels, and he was an assistant chief in charge of this fire. He said, stand fast. We stood fast. You could see this was not going to be quickly extinguished, this fire. The chief turned to me and said, 33 engine, go around to 23rd Street. We think this fire spread to the building behind us. So chief, report to Chief Riley, Thomas Riley. So we run around to 23rd Street. I see Chief Riley standing in front of a building 6 East 23rd Street, directly opposite the fire building. I reported, and he says, "Stand fast, 33 engine." We look in, there's a light on, there's one the drugstore, no fire here. You know, I'm kind of wanting to go back to 22nd Street. So then the 18 engine officer, Joe Pereira, who I knew, reports to Riley. He's standing on his left side. I'm standing on his right side. He tells 18 to stand fast. again, out of this Wonder drugstore comes a fire patrolman. These were insurance guys who would throw covers and protect property from fire. He comes out and he tells Chief Riley, "Chief, we got fire on the baseboards in the drugstore." So Riley turns to Joe Priori, Lieutenant Joe Priori, says, "Stretch a line in the drugstore, 33 engine. You stretch a line into exposure on Broadway, next to the building." So we follow the orders. I watch Riley. I watch, I see this fella, Jack Finley from 7 Truck, throw on a mask. He heads into the drugstore. So we go around to Broadway. We stretch a line up to the second floor. We're operating with this Chief White. He says, 33, get a tool, force this bathroom door. I think there's a window that can give us a shot with a hose line. We had a 2.5-inch hose line there to this area between the two buildings that we think the fire is located. We really didn't decide and locate this fire properly. But anyway, so we go to force the door to the bathroom. We see this window there. He says, "Break that window. If you shoot the line out there." All of a sudden, we get the word, "Everybody get out of the building, get out of the building." We saw, I think I saw a flash through the, it was one of those stained white glass windows, and I think I heard a rumble. That's about it. So we get out of the building, we back out of the building, and we set up a line on downstairs. Fire's in the building, 940 Broadway. I remember, again, with a hose line, waiting with a hose line, the big plate glass window to the store where we're going to operate on Broadway. Now, we're still on Broadway. It's pulsating, you know, there's fire and condensation on the inside. You can't see through the glass, but it's really breathing. So then they take the glass out. We open up the hose line. We're fighting the fire on Broadway. And that's what I remember. Then about 10 o'clock, you know, we're there. It's a fourth or fifth alarm fire, probably about 10 or 11. An assistant chief comes by and says, "Did anybody see Chief Riley? Anybody?" I said, "Yeah, I reported to Chief Riley." He said, "When did you get here?" "On the second alarm." I said, so they really did not know, you know, who, how many firefighters died, where they died. Maybe some, I think Chief Hay did, and few other people, but the word did not get around to the rest of the troops. So that was basically it. What happened was, now after the investigation, we know a lot more. Riley walks into the drugstore. Higgins, Lieutenant Chief, Battalion Chief Higgins is in there. But let's step back a second. When Riley was in front of the one the drugstore, before I got there, Riley sends 5 engine and 3 truck down to the basement of the one the drugstore. There's an inside stairway right as you go into the drugstore to the left. It's an inside stairway to the basement. You know, he's a veteran fire chief, so he knows you got to sell a fire on 22nd, to burn through within the cellar on 23rd. So down goes this Lieutenant Royal Fox with 3 truck and 5 engine goes down there. And 5 engine, it says to this firefighter, "Sister, you stay at the top of this stairway here on the first floor. Move these boxes off the stairs so if we have to make a fast exit, we'll get out of here." So Cicero stays at the top of the stairs. They go down. 5 engine and 3 truck go down and they go back to the back at his cellar, and they see a cinder block wall there. Now they pull the ceiling, and Royal Fox says, "Hey, reports, don't tell the chief we got a And tell the chief we got a small fire here in the basement, nothing. You just send the line down with five engine and we'll control it. That's it. What they didn't know was that the building on 22nd Street had an art framing business in the basement. The business was so good that they expanded and they broke through the cellar walls and they connected the back of the building on 22nd Street and took over 35 feet of the building on 23rd Street. So they were operating a business underneath the Wonder Drugstore, the back third of that building. It was an illegal renovation. They knocked down the wall. They connected the cellars. And the wall that Royal Fox saw and pulled the ceiling was a new wall that they built. It was 35 feet into the Wonder Drugstore. And in right behind that wall, there were drums of lacquer, varnish, dinner, used in this art framing store, burning furiously and destroying the floor above, the first floor of the back of the Wonder Drugstore. So they get the hose line down there and now go back to when Riley and Jack Finley and Higgins, Chief Walter Higgins, walk into the 23rd Street Wonder Drugstore. They go to the back. They go to look at this fire burning out the baseboard, and they're standing over the fire that's blowing out the cellar door of 22nd Street. And then suddenly the floor collapses. It was a terrazzo floor. It was 5 inches of concrete and 1 inch of marbleized chips, polished, fancy, looking good, on top of an old 100-year-old wood beam floor. Then all the wood beams had burned away. And this terrazzo floor insulated the heat of the fire below and gave no sign of collapse until big chunks of it fell down. 10 of them fell into the fire, Riley, Higgins, and 2 of the drivers tried to scramble back out after the collapse, and they were killed by a big ball of fire that came roaring out the first floor after the floor collapsed in the back of the Wonder Drugstore. Now, Royal Fox and there's 8 other firefighters down there, including Fox, down in the basement when this collapse happens. Now, Cicero, who was told to stay at the top of the stairs, inside stairs, cellar stairs, starts to yell down, "Hey, Cap, there's something wrong. Lieutenant, something wrong. Get out here." He feels a big draft of air shoot in to the back of the store when the floor collapses, and then a big ball of fire blows back out, reverse, blows back out. And he's yelling, "Get out of the basement, get out of the basement." So now they start to scramble up the interior cellar stair to the first floor to get out to the street. And there's so much fire that nobody wants to go. So this guy, Royal Fox, who was just in another cellar fire where guys died, he starts to push everybody up. Get up, get out, or we'll never get out of here. So he pushes these other 7 other firefighters and scrambles out himself. And they're burned, crawling under the fire to get out of the Wonder Drugstore as this fire flows out after the collapse. So we really could have 20 firefighters killed at that fire. But there were 12. 10 went down into the basement. 2 were killed with the ball of fire that came up afterwards. And so that was the 23rd Street fire, the big tragedy, only eclipsed by 911. And I was just making some notes. You know, what did we learn here? What happened after that fire in 23rd Street? And there were several things that changed in the FDNY. First of all, we understood that you have to locate a fire. You know, we talk about size up. We got to locate a fire before you can size it up accurately. So we then started talking about locating fires. You know, we would identify the smell of smoke, which would, we knew the kitchen fire, the bedroom fire, if it was rope burning. You might look into a roof closet with cleaning supplies, a mop. We then started looking at using elevators, how dangerous it was. You don't use an elevator to check out a cellar fire. And when we, you know, we would always tell our firefighters at these big commercial buildings, you got to find the location of the fire from a person, but then you got to check the alarm panel. Sometimes it doesn't match. If you get two floors, you start searching at the lower floor. So locating a fire became a big thing. We always, you know, you don't go to a store fire in New York City without checking the basement. The first thing you go and tell at any store fire is, hey, did anybody check the basement here? So that's the legacy. We don't realize it, but that's the legacy of the 23rd Street collapse. We always remind somebody, check the basement. What have we got down the basement? We might be fighting a fire on the first floor, and we got a basement fire. So that's one of the big points of locating a fire. Second thing we learned after that, you know, you need communications, and we didn't have radios at that fire. You know, it's hard to believe, but only the chiefs had radios. After the 23rd Street fire, all officers were issued a radio, and the pump operator was issued a radio. If you were in a truck, the roof, the firefighter got a radio. So now today, everybody has radios, but that was a big innovation, cost a lot of money. Everybody was against it from the city fathers, but we knew we needed radios, so now we got all the radios. And so our communications improved tremendously. Also, riding lists. We, after that fire, you know, we didn't know who died. They were looking for names, who was working that night. So now we had a procedure set up, our accountability system. Every time you went on tour of duty, the officer had to write up a riding list. He would put his name, all the names of the firefighters on a list, and he'd make two copies. And one would stay, they would be put on the dashboard of the fire truck. And when you responded, you had to take one copy, hand it to the incident commander. And he would keep that record. And if he got killed, he either could go back to the apparatus, and the other copy was on the dashboard of the apparatus. So we finally got an accountability system as a result of that. That was another innovation or change in the fire service writing list. And we realized that this building had an illegal renovation, and the building department didn't know about it. And when we looked at their records, they had very strange records regarding this building. But we knew we needed closer communications between the fire service and the building service, building department service. So we set up a program where every time there was a major alteration in New York City, the building department would notify the fire department, and they sent us a report. We would call it a majolt, major alteration. When we got notified of a major alteration taking place in your district, the deputy chief had to go out and check out this alteration and make sure it was legal and make sure we would not have any problems finding the fire and fighting a fire in it. And another result of that majolt, after you did the inspection of the major alteration in the building, we started this program called TIPS, Tactical Information of Perilous Situations, and really was forerunner to our SITS program. But the chief, when he saw a hazard at this major alteration, would make a diagram of the change in the building. He would write down what the hazards were, and he would have to make a firefighting action plan for the incident commander. All this information was put on a microfiche, and deputies carried a big file of microfiche with these tactical informations of perilous situations that were picked up by chiefs, and would help us at fires. So that was one of the results of that fire. And we also started using Hi-X foam for cellar fires. We used cellar pipes, and they were just as dangerous. You know, we had to cut a hole over the fire and operate there. So we started an indirect attack using Hi-X foam. Now, we did tests on Hi-X foam, and I used it at fires. It would not put out the cellar fire. But what it did was, if you filled up the cellar with Hi-X phone, the smoke and the heat would subside temporarily with the coolness of these air bubbles down there. And what that did was give you a chance to get up to the floors above, evacuate any people up there, and it gave you time to set up aerial master streams, because that is the final solution to most cellar fires, using an aerial master stream as the fire spreads up through the entire commercial building. So cellar fires down in lower Manhattan were a deadly fire. You know, each year there would be some tragedy down there. Royal Fox survived a fire in Broadway just a year before the 23rd Street fire, where three firefighters were killed in the cellar. So he was pretty experienced in cellar disasters. And so he was really the hero of that fire. And I was just reminded after that fire, I really didn't think much of that fire. After the fire was out, I was a lieutenant. I was on a captain's list. You know, I wanted to be a chief. And I remember going to the funeral, you know, and I was in the investigation, but I really didn't think about it, you know. I wanted to, you know, be somebody in the fire service. I went on, I made a captain, battalion chief, deputy chief, and then 10 years later, I'm a deputy, got what I wanted, and I'm up in the Bronx, and I start to have to write a strategy and tactics procedures, and I start to write about building collapse, floor collapse, wall collapse, ceiling collapse, stairway collapse. I cannot stop writing about building collapse, you know. So I even told my wife, I said, Pat, I feel like I'm vomiting these words out. I don't know where this is coming from, but I have to write about building collapse. I was writing for Firehouse Magazine. And the editor, John Page at the time, tells me, Vin, you got to stop writing about building collapse. I'm writing this column, Fire Studies at the time. Jim Smith has it now. And he says, you got to stop writing about building collapse. I said, well, if you want me to stop writing about building collapse, I'm going to stop writing. That's all I want to do. So he let me go, thank God. And I wrote about building collapse. And then years later, I remember giving a lecture out in Dublin, Ohio, and at that time, you know, stress debriefing after tragedies became, you know, a part of the fire service, you know, and I remember I'm up in the state talking about building collapse, and I said, geez, if we had stress debriefing back in 1966, I might not have written the book Collapse of Burning Buildings. So then I realized that writing that book and writing those articles about collapse, that was my post-traumatic stress debriefing. I exercised my demons by writing that book. You know, I got that delayed thought about the 23rd Street fire out of my mind by writing about that. So that was basically how somebody's life career goes on. But just recently,
the legacy from that event certainly goes well beyond the tragedy of that situation, as you just described. I mean, you have provided and given the fire service a tremendous wealth of information and insights that unfortunately began with that incident and alarm on October 17th of 1966. You know, the one thing that our listeners should not forget about, and Joe, you know, you talk a lot about Main Street Ops for Type 3s, but this particular complex or the building itself, for just the purpose, for the listeners who aren't aware of how the orientation is, we're primarily dealing with two buildings that were oriented almost like an inverted T. The Wonder Drugs, which was which we could consider to be on the left side of that, or excuse me, on the right side, the 6 East 23rd Street, was an L-shaped type building, about 50 by 100. The adjacent building, which Vinny, as you talked about, that was located on East 22nd Street, was just a very narrow, conventional type 3, approximately 20 by 100. So, you know, we have these narrow buildings, one 20 by 100, the other 50 by 100 with an L-shaped extension, which had this interconnected cellar conditions. Although based upon some of the information that has been put out there, both the Board of Inquiry as well as some of the other documentation, there were some fire doors and some other separations. But this building, to some degree, could exist in any one of a series of communities throughout the country. I mean, whether we talk about a small main street in the middle of Nebraska, or a metro urbanized type setting. So our listeners, when we put this in the context of a very complex operation within FDNY, within Manhattan, could certainly be present in a similar fashion, either a standalone building or the complexities of two adjacent buildings, one on either side of a city block. So, you know, these lessons really resonate today. Joe, what's your take on some of the aspects? I mean, if either you talk about the Wonder Drugs as a standalone building or the aspects of what would have been present on the other side on East 22nd Street, I mean, these are pretty typical buildings, as well as the cellars, as well as the whole challenge dealing with either interconnected cellars that are open from street front to street front in those areas, or other aspects that are common in buildings well over 100 years of age.
Yeah, you know, first off, I want to thank Chief Dunn for sharing this story. I could listen. I've listened to you tell this story many times, and I could listen to you tell it 100 more times. But I would say that of all the line of duty deaths that have some legacy or some age to them, many firefighters will kind of brush off to the side older events or older line of duty deaths, and they'll say, well, you know, that was back before whatever PPE or technology or whatever, doesn't apply to me now today in 2018. Well, let me tell you, of a lot of the line of duty deaths in this country, that one resonates today. It will resonate 20 years from now, 25 years from now, probably 50 years from now, because we still have those kind of aged buildings where you have renovations. And if you have type 3 ordinary constructed buildings, you have to study this fire. And it's all about the renovation and working together with your building department and those that inspect or getting information out. I will say one other thing, a lot of these little things that took place back, tactics and strategies that took place, you know, years ago, like leaving a firefighter at the top of the stairs, it's unheard of today. You don't hear about it. You don't talk about it. I don't always see it done because, well, everybody has a radio. Well, that, I say that it's a legacy tip for the modern fire company that today, you still may want to leave. In fact, you do want to leave somebody at the top of the basement stairs to warn you of problems. So, you know, this fire, it is awfully close to me. I remember it more than just on October 17th. But I encourage our listeners to really get into this fire and understand it and to remember some of the tips and, you know, to remember not only those that passed, but the heroes like, you know, Chief Dunn, Royal Fox. Royal Fox, I believe, is still alive and still around. And, you know, what he did was quite a heroic act. What he did as far as getting those firefighters through that fire and out that front door.
No, I agree with everything you said. Actually, they were all ordinary constructed buildings. You go to any downtown center main street of any city in America, and you find these old 100-year-old ordinary constructed buildings, and especially with the cellars interconnected and renovations after renovations. So this is not a high-rise building. This was, one building was four stories, with a basement. The building on 23rd Street was a five-story, 50 by 100, had three stores in it, three little stores, the drugstore, a lingerie store, and a candy store. It was a very small, the drugstore was about a 20-foot-wide store, so it was not an imposing building. But, you know, any of those older center city main streets of any city have these buildings and interconnected and plenty of renovations, and they all could, you could have a fire like that. And it was not a, it was a light smoke condition. I remember looking in that drugstore. I said, there's no fire here. Let's get around where the action is. And, of course, they all walked in there and died. I mean, that was, so even a light wisp of smoke can be a deadly warning. And, no, it was, it's a typical fire. And it was some lessons learned there. Nothing unusual at the fire except the deaths of all those firefighters. And but we did, you know, we did have some lessons learned. And every fire you go through, you have a lesson learned. And that's one of the things I always realized, that every fire, you got to think about what you do. I mean, not at the fire, but when you come back, you think, well, what happened at that fire? You know, I just see on, you know, I hear at night, I said, what did you have last night for fires? Yeah, a couple of car fires. And there was just a fire training clip, video of a car fire on Facebook where the gasoline was leaking on the street. Firefighters didn't know it, and it blows up on them, and it engulfs them in flame. So that's a typical car fire. You say, I just had a car fire. You know, well, let's describe that car fire. You had leaking gasoline. You had people trapped in the car. You had to cut them out, put a neck brace on them. You had cars whizzing by 60 miles an hour, and, you know, the flames and the gasoline could explode at any moment. It's more than just a car fire. And that's what I learned, you know, for the rest of, you know, like you said, my writing, I laugh. I'm still writing every single day. And, you know, my wife said, you have an obsessive compulsion. That is, you know, is it a talent? Is it a talent, a creative talent? I realize it's an obsessive compulsive disorder I have. I cannot stop writing about the fire service. So, but which is a good obsessive compulsive disorder. I write. That's good for me. It's good for anybody who reads it. But
You know, let's take advantage and we'll leverage that statement again for our listeners. Chief Dunn recently published a new book on building construction called A Firefighter's Battle Space. And again, this is published through the FDNY Foundation and Pro Books. And I would certainly, as Joe would also, as the chief, reinforce to our listeners that this is an exceptional book that is another companion to all of the other editions of books that that Chief Dunn has published. But again, the insights relative to some of the current challenges and operations. But again, as you go through, as we talk about on type threes or warehouse or loft building battle spaces, it's all about these various topical areas and discussion points and learnings, the continued lessons that are out there. So we certainly do encourage our listeners to take a look at some of the information. There's a great section on ordinary construction, battle spaces, and much of what we're talking about here on this episode. You know, again, you know, we talk about the alterations, and again, we take a look at the, you know, some of the similarities, although not in a type of commercial building, but certainly in a tenement condition when we talk about the events of Black Sunday on January 23rd, 2005, where, again, unofficial and undocumented alterations took place that changed the configurations. And as the companies are moving through, they're expecting certain walls to be in a certain orientation based upon search patterns and floor movement and windows and so forth. And when they're not there, that certainly should be a heads up. You know, we, all of us, our companies get acclimated and become accustomed to searching and moving through the types of structures that they regularly respond and work in. And when something doesn't feel right or doesn't conform to what you're expecting, that should sort of be a stop point, and further assessment should be done to try to identify what's different about the space or condition. You know, the importance of the size up first and foremost, and again, clearly identifying or knowing as a company officer or as a BC in the street, you need to understand what the footprint is relative to that building. So as an example, if we have a 20 by 100 foot building with a footprint that upon entry at the entry point, and you have got a basement fire, it should equate to two lengths of 50-foot hose in terms of going from entry point to the rear division of that particular back wall. And as Chief Tracy talked to us, he says, you know, one of the things is, you know, we take a look, if I've got a 100-foot, 150-foot depth or what have you, I'm stretching into the basement, and suddenly I hit a wall or some other condition that does not allow me to proceed further into that basement, and I'm only at a length of 50 feet, that should be a heads up saying that I've got another section of wall, you know, on the other side of this barrier or condition that may have other situations, other fire conditions, and so forth. So the important message there that Tracy was telling us, and we transferred back to the class, was you got to know that footprint. You need to understand what your lengths of hoses may be, your travel distances as one proceeds, and if you do hit up an obstruction or bulkhead or some other condition, that should be again a critical point where you need to reevaluate where you're at, and not just keep on going. You may have a wall, as this was, you know, in a space that wasn't expected, with fire on the other side of it, affecting structural conditions and so forth.
Yeah, the thing is, commercial buildings are much more dangerous than residential buildings. We are experts in fighting residential building fires. That's where we do most of our firefighting. But commercial buildings are much more dangerous. The occupancies contain flammable and explosive liquids. The layouts are different. We're not familiar with them. The renovations have changed the structure. So when you go into a strip store, you're going into a dangerous building. And, you know, it's not the same as a residential building. The other thing that, you know, we inspect buildings, the same lesson learned at 911, the construction of a building, doing a survey and doing an inspection, look not for the fire hazards, but for the structural hazards. And that's a big thing. Inspecting the buildings. We do inspections, and nobody really likes to do inspections because we're giving out violations and getting everybody angry. But the real benefit to the firefighter is we're looking at inside the building. We're looking at the cellars, floors. We're looking, hey, look at that truss. So knowing the inside of a building, and now we realize the inside of that World Trade Center was a disaster. It was a lightweight constructed open bar joist that we really didn't understand. So inspecting buildings, doing a survey and a firefighting action plan based on the construction is vital. And again, buildings are not buildings are not buildings. Commercial buildings are more deadly than residential buildings.
And again, it's that understanding. If the easiest thing that our listeners can focus in on is, you know, what do you have in your first due? It may be a lot more complexities in terms of a battalion or a district or a division, but, you know, think about your first due response area. Think about identifying those type 3 structures or things that have similarities here. And really the question that our listeners should be asking themselves, especially those that are in supervisory company level positions or in command level positions of authority, what is it that you know, and more importantly, what is it that you don't know? Do you understand what the type 3 construction features and predictabilities may be on spans and how they are utilized in various vintages, as well as those that, again, are of type 3, type 4 construction. And then more importantly, the fact that these buildings are old, first and foremost, and again, based upon their longevity, the likelihood of two things, either deteriorating conditions that will affect structural integrity, or the modifications and alterations that more than likely have occurred over different periods. They were built in the turn of the 1800s. Chances are there were probably renovations that occurred in the 50s or 60s. And then again, if those buildings still exist all the way to today, there have been modifications of recent. Normally that lifespan and things that occur at about a 20 to 30 year time frame, or the change in occupancy usage, which again will change things around. And you know, bearing walls will suddenly get removed and be replaced by some other type of support, whether it be in the cellars or basement locations that may affect the integrity of that entire bearing wall, or just the support configurations. We've been into many types of structures where, again, the removal of key structural elements, whether they be beams or girders or column areas, as well as the introduction of lightweight engineered construction within the shells of these buildings that change them around. So one would think that you may have the integrity of legacy and the fully dimensioned lumber and timber, when in fact it may have been gutted out, especially as the occupancies have changed into other possible bars or theaters or other types of socialized kinds of occupancies. And that engineered construction will give you much less degree of operational time. So the importance about understanding and knowing and getting out there and looking at your buildings, officially or unofficially, is another takeaway for everyone's purposes.
Yeah, if I could just add one more thing, there is the biggest warning sign that you could find as a firefighter that screams "size me up" is a yard dumpster. If you find a yard dumpster on your main street or in your area, your response area, stop, look and see, be nosy. That means they're probably doing some sort of renovation or demolition inside of that building, and you can get a lot of info by stopping. So I encourage you, if you see a yard dumpster or some kind of receptacle for garbage, big we call them yard dumpsters where I'm from here, is stop and look, and that means that there's some sort of renovation going on. It's the best intel you could get as a company.
I would just like to summarize. There's four factors involved in burning building collapse. First of all, the age of a building. A building that's 75 or 100 years old is outlived its structure. The wood shrinks, the concrete loses its adhesive quality. If you don't renovate the building after 75 or 100 years, it becomes a collapse danger. Lightweight construction, open bar joists, lightweight wood trusses, C-beams, they are all lightweight construction that's going to affect burning building collapse. Vacant buildings, even if it's not an old building, if it's empty for 5 years and the weather and rain and snow gets after it, a vacant building is a collapse danger. And finally, bad renovations. Renovations have to be made, but if it's an illegal or bad renovation, it makes it into a collapse danger. The 23rd Street Fire had two of those four indicators of burning building collapse. It was a 100-year-old building and had bad renovation.
And that, again, are the lessons and the takeaways. And I think, Chief Bernesti, any closing comments or observations that you can add on to Chief Dunn's comments?
No, I think I would like to ask Chief Dunn real quick what his thought was on the Board of Inquiry. I've always wanted to ask you, on the Board of Inquiry that was done on this fire, do you feel that there was anything that could have been maybe done differently or written differently, or your own thoughts of the Board of Inquiry, the investigation back in 66 on that fire?
I do. That was a tremendous investigation. Chief of Department John T. O'Hagan conducted that investigation. There's a report, probably 30 pages and diagrams in the fire department library. This was a tremendously effective and good investigation. It's written, and I read it every time I have to give a little presentation on 23rd Street collapse. It's the investigation, written investigation of the 23rd Street collapse, 1966, by the chief of department, John T. O'Hagan. It was a great investigation.
All right. In closing, again, I want to thank our guests and my brothers, Deputy Chief Vinnie Dunn and Assistant Chief Joseph Pernesti. As always, thank you very, very much for your insights and sharings. You know, the legacy of the 23rd Street fire continues on. The Hispanic Society established a medal of heroism to honor, since the inception, again, in 1968, to honor those FDNY firefighters for acts of heroism. And again, that that medal and honor was established for the valor of the firefighters that lost their lives on the 23rd Street fire. I would encourage, and actually only the other thing I wanted to make mention of, and again, Vinny, you might just add in a little bit, that at the Fire Academy, FDNY Fire Academy, again, the streets that surround the academy and the training grounds were named after the 12 firefighters that perished on the 23rd Street fire. Is that correct?
That is correct. You know, they named the streets for the 12 firefighters, two chiefs, two company officers, and eight firefighters, and two chiefs drivers were killed in that. So it was 12, two, a deputy battalion chief, two lieutenants, and eight firefighters, two of which were drivers for the 3rd Division and for the 7th Battalion. And my friend Rudy Kaminsky was driving the 7th Battalion that night. Rudy and I went to school, Queens College, together on the GI Bill. And Rudy wrote an article, he told me one day, about how to put out a fire, crawl down a hallway and extinguish a fire. And the class stood up and clapped when he was over. He got an A in English for that. So Rudy Kaminsky, my friend.
And again, I would encourage our listeners who have not taken advantage of this opportunity, but if you go to the FDNYPro.org page, again, it supports the FDNY Foundation. If you subscribe to the online services, there is an exceptionally well-produced and very poignant memorial that was put together that is titled My Father's House. And this dealt with the legacy of Lieutenant Joseph Priori and primarily focused in on the insights provided to his young daughter, Christine, who was only 6 months old at the time of that event. And it goes on to explain sort of the journey, but more importantly, I think that the lessons and the learnings and the true measure of brotherhood and never forgetting and the honor that's bestowed each and every year at the annual services, along with what it means to be a brother firefighter on the job, and certainly in FDNY, were exhibited in that production. So I can't say enough about our listeners taking the time, if nothing else, taking the time to view that particular video production that's only available online through the subscription and garner some insights from that standpoint. Again, we are honoring the 12 who lost their lives at the 23rd Street fire. There's certainly a lot of lessons to be learned, a lot more insights for our listeners that aren't familiar with it. I would encourage you to go online. There's a variety of resources that are out there. Our produced firegroundleadership.com does have a story and a blog posting that provides insight, as well as some links to a variety of other resources that will provide you with a level of detail and insights to garner some further knowledge that will help you to pre-plan, become more aware of the hazards and challenges, not only from the event, but how they apply to your particular jurisdiction and district. And in closing, again, we'll take a moment on October 17th to pay homage to our brothers' remembrance, honor, and sacrifice, and the courage. Again, Thomas Riley, Deputy Chief of the 3rd Division, Walter Higgins, Battalion Chief of 7th Battalion, Lieutenant John Finley of Ladder 7, Firefighter Rudolph Kaminsky, Firefighter Joseph Kelly of 18 Engine, Firefighter Carl Lee of 7 Ladder, Joseph Priori, Lieutenant of Engine Company 18, John Berry, Firefighter, Ladder 7, William McCarran, Firefighter of the 3rd Division, James Gallinaw, Firefighter of 18 Engine, Bernard Tepper, Firefighter, Engine 18, and Daniel Ray, Firefighter of 18 Engine. Those were the firefighters who, again, lost their lives doing what we all do each and every day. So, again, thank you, gentlemen, for your insights. And, again, this is your host, Chris Naum. Until next time, the companies are in quarters and off the air. Stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets in your city, across the country, and around the world doing what we do best, being who we are, and that is firefighters. So take care, everyone. Thank you.
Looking for timely information and insights to support today's fire service demands? Firegroundleadership.com provides outstanding e-media offerings across a broad range of topics that include lessons from the fireground, building construction and fire dynamics, adaptive fireground management, tactical discipline, and much more. Firegroundleadership.com, operational excellence on today's evolving fireground. A buildingsonfire.com series, now on Penwell's Fire EMS blog, a part of the fireengineering.com, Firefighter Nation, Fire Rescue Magazine, eMedia Services.